It was the cynic Ambrose Bierce who described history like this. He said, history is an account of events, mostly unimportant, which are brought about by rulers, mostly knaves, and soldiers, mostly fools. Well, tonight we're going to be looking at a couple of rulers, plenty of soldiers, and a coronation in an obscure Middle Eastern country several thousand years ago. So Mark may be feeling it would have been better off to stay watching Wimbledon. And you may think it almost proves his point. Actually, though, I think it's what Alex Haley said about history that may spring to mind first. Alex Haley wrote that history is written by the winners. Or as Winston Churchill put it, and you imagine with the same idea in the back of his mind, history will be kind to me. I intend to write it. Well, if you were with us last week, we were faced with 9 chapters of genealogies and endless names. This week it's refreshing to get a story we can understand as we face up to Saul and David, though if you've been looking ahead, you'll see there are plenty more names to come in the couple of chapters we're looking at tonight. And then, as you look at it, you begin to wonder, what kind of history is this? I mean, it's so negative about Saul and so positive at first sight about David. You know, that adultery with Bathsheba airbrushed out. Is this some government inquiry whitewash? I need to understand, as I come to look at it, what I've called the history of the chronicler, the way he writes. I mean, those 9 chapters of genealogies can be misleading if I imagine he wrote a plain, genealogical, statistical, just the cold, hard facts history. As Mark Prentice showed us last week, they were actually arranged to tell us things. Things like who to trust. The God who's sovereign, even over forces outside of us or the sin that's within us. Things like where to look, arranged to show us that the lines of David and Aaron were the important ones to keep an eye on. And he continues to arrange his material to teach us his lessons. Oh, he knows stories ugly and exciting, Bathsheba and Goliath, they're all there in 2 Samuel. You could have looked them up before you started. More than that, the chronicler's writing for 2 groups of people. Not the contemporaries of Saul and David, they're long dead when he put pen to papyrus or whatever. But in his sight, the chronicler would have had those returning from exile to a country and a city that didn't live up to the brochure, the promises they'd heard about it. And coming as these books did right at the end of the Hebrew Bible, the last books of it, the chronicler writes to give them hope for the future. You know, we do that sometimes, don't we? You look back to get hope for the future. But as the Apostle Paul writes of another Old Testament history, there was a second audience that God had in mind for the chronicler's work. Paul wrote to the New Testament Christians at Corinth and said, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us. So come and explore the lessons the chronicler has for us in his history. And they begin with what I've called the Lord's King. See, as chapter 10 ends, the people are in chaos and despair. Israel is defeated. The Philistines triumphant. King Saul's committed suicide. His body, or at least his head, has become an addition to their temple trophy cabinet. His sons are all killed in the battle. The nation's left leaderless, defenseless, lost, vulnerable. The disappointment, the seeming powerlessness of those returning from exile with one eye on the ruin and the weakness of the nation and the other on the threat of their enemies, that disappointment's nothing new, the chronicler reminds them. The fear with which some Christians now look to the future, conscious perhaps for the first time in the West of being out-muscled, of a leadership and institutions incapable of standing up to the forces in society and the culture ranged against them. You know, economic, moral, religious powers. That fear's nothing new. God's people have been there before. The reason why King Saul's reign, which began with such promise, ended in such disasters, spelt out bluntly as the events of chapter 10 are summarized. I mean, look at verse 13 again. Saul died because he was unfaithful to the Lord. He didn't keep the word of the Lord and even consulted a medium for guidance and didn't inquire of the Lord. The Philistines may be the enemy, but it's the Lord, you notice, who's the key. He's the one controlling events. So verse 14, the Lord put him to death and turned the kingdom over to David, son of Jesse. Now, notice this, will you? Even when the people are reaping a just reward for their sin, when they're suffering defeat and invasion, God has prepared a rescuer for them. We won't be able to avoid facing despair and disappointment and fear, but even when they're at their darkest, the chronicler wants to remind us that the Lord is a Redeemer God, able not just to work His sovereign plan out of the mess, but His good purposes in it as well. I've been dealing with one of the messiest pastoral situations I've had to handle in the last few weeks, and the minister of another church involved in it has told me, he said, I keep telling them, the people stuck in the middle of it, there is a Redeemer God. He's got His purposes even in this. But the chronicler also wants to show us the importance of following the Lord's king. It's David, not Saul, whom the Lord has put His hand on, and he's the one to follow, and he's the king God's people did follow. So you see, when chapter 11 starts, here's how it begins. All Israel came together to David at Hebron and said, they gave three reasons why they would like to have him as their king. One, you're one of us, or we are your own flesh and blood. Two, you've got the right CV. Or, as they put it, in the past, even when Saul was king, you were the one who led Israel in their military campaigns. Three, and most importantly, you're God's choice. You see, there's a prophecy from God about you. The Lord God said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become that ruler. And the wisdom of God's choice becomes obvious in the next verse when you look at verse 3. When the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, he made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. See, a promise before God. He signed a treaty. He wrote a pledge to them. And almost certainly, David was endorsing what God's law said about his people's kings. Now look, if you've got your Bible with you, turn back. Keep a finger in 1 Chronicles. We're coming back there in just a moment. Turn back to Deuteronomy 17. It's page 196. Just listen to this. Well, look at it as you listen to this. Deuteronomy 17. Let me pick it up at verse 14. When you enter the land the Lord your God's giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, let's set a king over us like all the nations around us, be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. Well, that's wise, isn't it? He must be from among your fellow Israelites. Don't place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite. That's why they said, we're your flesh and blood. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you're not to go back that way again. He mustn't take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. And when he takes the throne of his kingdom, he's to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the Lord, of the Levitical priests. And it is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over the kingdom in Israel. They're great words, aren't they? And as you come back to 1 Chronicles, it seems as if David sat down and wrote the law and promised to keep and read it every day of his reign. Here's a limited monarchy, if you like. It's not a totalitarian despot, is it? Here is a humble serving leader, not a proud, greedy authoritarian. Here is the model king. And so, verse 3, they anointed David king over Israel, as the Lord had promised through Samuel. See, the king with a prophecy from God, the king with a promise before God, the king with the presence of God, so that he can capture his city. Verse 4, David and all the Israelites marched on Jerusalem, that is Jebus. The Jebusites who lived there said to David, you won't get in here. Well, they were wrong, weren't they? He doesn't seem to bother with any of the details. He just wants to say they were wrong. Nevertheless, David captured the fortress. And why? Well, look at verse 9. Because the Lord Almighty was with him. Now, if the human historical focus is on David, the chronicler keeps reminding us of the real sovereign, the Lord. The Lord fought against Saul at the end of chapter 10. The beginning of chapter 11, he fights with David. And the Lord explains the agenda for those returning from exile in disappointment. Jerusalem, Zion, the city of David, it's in ruins. But it isn't just the historical seat of royal power. It's the city God won for them, to which he gave his name. So rebuilding Jerusalem rightly takes on importance, the importance it has for the disappointed from exile. And King David's descendants may have been one of the reasons why the people were sent into exile, but the chronicler's starting to remind them that the king to gather round, the king who'll bring blessing, is still from David's line, the one God promised. He writes for them, but God says he writes to us. And reminds us too, not just of the importance of God's city, the new Jerusalem in the new heaven and earth, that's where our hopes need to be pinned. But he reminds us too of the importance of waiting for God's king. Of being found alongside not the Sauls of this world, the leaders God's rejected, but David. Or rather, great David's greater son, the promised Messiah. Oh, he's just as David was during Saul's reign. He may be banished and sidelined. He may be seemingly blocked from the levers of power now, but Jesus remains the king to wait for. The king through whom God will build his kingdom. And when the day comes and rulers are toppled and leaders fall and God's king is crowned in glory and the Lord's promises are fulfilled, will you have been on his side? Or will you have been blind to this history and deaf to the chronicler's encouragement? Wait for the Lord's king. Now, if you're anything like me, talking about waiting for is a sort of innocuous but rather boring sounding phrase, isn't it? In David's case, there were actually years of near civil war between the Lord choosing him and his coming to the throne. Years of Saul's jealousy and pursuit of him. Years when, as we'll see in chapter 12, people still gathered round David. And it actually took 7 years between Saul's death and David's coronation. Years of bitter feuding between the houses of David and Saul, as 2 Samuel records. But the chronicler's editing and arranging his material to highlight his lesson from history. The choice always in front of us. The leader unfaithful and rejected, or the Lord's king, around whom the Lord's people gather. And waiting for him doesn't mean doing nothing. It's not sit back in your armchair and snatch a look at your watch every now and then and wonder how much longer. It's not even occasionally getting on your knees. As the chronicler tells his story, around the Lord's king gathers the king's army. Chapters 11 and 12 list those who make up his army, and we'll see they're a very varied bunch. By the end, the chronicler tells us, day after day, men came to help David until he had a great army like the army of God. And one of the striking things as you read through these couple of chapters is what a mix there is to this army gathered round the Lord's king. All Israel came together to David. Chapter 11 begins. All the elders of Israel had come to King David. And I guess you could divide them up any number of ways, but here's one writer's list that I nicked. He spoke of the adventurous there in verses 6 to 24. They're the sort of exciting boys' own hero types. David's extraordinary selection process for field marshal. You know, first one over the parapet gets the job. And in verse 6, Joab won the right to that uniform. I don't know whether it makes him a field marshal. At least you know your leader's got guts. And then, as you read on, you'll come across the seeming sort of testosterone-fueled atmosphere of the day. Here's David desperate for water, longing for it. He said, oh, if only someone could get me a drink of water from Bethlehem. But Bethlehem's enemy-occupied territory, Philistine-occupied territory. All the same, verses 18 and 19, three men go on an SAS-style raid to get it for him. Andy McNab would no doubt turn it into his latest airport thriller. When they return, David refuses to drink it. It's as if his feet have been brought back to solid ground, as if he's come to his senses that it's replaced the false bravado. He doesn't want to be the leader for whom others have to risk their lives so that he can enjoy his perks. And then there's the likes of Benaiah in verses 22 to 25, a mighty warrior and the subject of one of the Bible's most extraordinary throwaway lines. See it at the end of verse 22? He also went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. Well, there's one for you to meditate on when you've got a sort of rainy Sunday afternoon to work out what's going on there. At the very least, these exploits are the chronicler's way of telling us the Lord is with those who are with his king. And the adventurous, they're followed by the overshadowed. Verses 26 to 47, the long list, Dimity is so grateful I didn't choose as tonight's reading. Michael Wilcock in his commentary says how he wanted to call them the anonymous, except for the fact that the one thing, the only thing we know about them is their names. What an encouragement to those who feel we've got nothing to bring, just ourselves. And then as you come into chapter 12, there's the relatives. Chapter 12 is a flashback, by the way. It winds the clock back from David being crowned king to when he was in Ziklag on the run from King Saul. And even back then, people were gathering around the Lord's king, and not just any people. Look at the end of verse 2. He says, they were relatives of Saul from the tribe of Benjamin. If the chronicler wants to remind us, you don't stand on tribal loyalties when it comes to gathering around the Lord's king. You don't refuse to sign up because your tribe aren't dominant, or your type aren't running things, or it's not the kind of thing your family does. Here's an example of encouragement still very much alive today. The brave are there. Verses 8 to 15, some Gadites defected to David at his stronghold in the wilderness. They were brave warriors, just the people you'd want on your side. And even the cautious drift along from 19 to 37. See, as the clock catches up again with David's coronation, so the list of those joining this army grows, some very late in the day. As Saul headed for defeat against the Philistines, and it was obvious which way the wind was blowing, you didn't really need to be a prophet to know which side you ought to be on. Some later still, even when Saul was dead and defeated, and yet they were counted in as well. See, we've watched tonight Jack and Cameron and Ming Wei start, in all probability, relatively early in their lives. Ernest came to Christ when he was 90. Cutting it fine? Certainly. Too late? No. There's not a bar on late arrivals. And so by the time you get to verse 22 of chapter 12, day after day, men came to help David until he had a great army like the army of God. And these are the numbers of the men, armed for battle, who came to David at Hebron to turn Saul's kingdom over to him, as the Lord had said. Cautiously slow to come, some. Suspicious in terms of their tribal background, others. Skills, weapons, talents, numbers, they were welcome. The only issue seemed to be the issue he raises in verse 17. If you've come to me in peace to help me, I'm ready for you to join me. And in the next verse, verse 18, the Spirit-filled Amasai says, great reminder, David, your God will help you. This is the army you've gathered round the Lord's king. We're yours, David, he says. We are with you, son of Jesse. Success, success to you, success to those who help you, for your God will help you. The Lord's blessing comes to those who help the Lord's King. Well, there's a message the chronicler has for those confused, disappointed, scratching their head in bewilderment at what to do as they've returned from the exile and they find things so far short of promise and expectation. But here's a message for us as well. To bring our gifts. To bring our boldness. To bring our discernment. To bring our readiness to roll up our sleeves and get stuck in. Or to bring just our names to add, not to a list of also-rans, but a list of they also served. Whether it's time, talents, money, or just a pair of hands. The King's army. And the New Testament still uses the military metaphor, though it really speaks of this diversity in terms of different members with different gifts belonging to the same body. But the New Testament insists that our weapons are spiritual, not violent. That the King we gather round gave his life for his enemies. We've got to renounce the caricature of religions. We copy neither the Islamic jihadist suicide bomber nor the abortion clinic arsonist as we gather round to serve with him as he builds his kingdom. Well, look, the book of Judges, it ends, as many of you know, with that famous line about everyone doing what was right in their own eyes. The book of Chronicles begins with a very different vision, doesn't it? All Israel come together to David, united around the Lord's King, integrated and helping together. And the chronicler says, are you part of that? The last word in the Hebrew Bible, not just wait for the Lord's King, but you wait for the Lord's King by joining the King's army. And our chapter 12 here ends with all Israel gathered round, determined to make David king over all Israel, and a great 3-day feast to celebrate. The King's story never ends, of course. But its final, endless chapter, that starts, as Revelation 7 puts it, with all Israel gathered round the King, 12,000 from each tribe, or a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people and language, standing before the throne and the Lamb, the Lord's King, Jesus. And it's just the prelude to the greatest feast of them all. The chronicler knows the sense of weakness now. At Ziklag, David was far more outlaw than king. He knows the disappointment now, a third-rate city in a second-rate temple. He knows the disillusionment now, sidelined by those of influence, patronized at best by our culture. But he asks, will you be there then? In that crowd gathered round the king then? And if you're going to be, he reminds us, we need to be among the army that's brought what gifts and courage they had to support him now. And it's his kingdom we sing of in our last hymn. Let's stand to do just that.